Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage Podcast. I'm your host, John Slick-Belm. Here on the Aerospace Advantage Podcast, we speak with leaders in the DoD, industry, and subject matter experts to explore the intersection between strategy, operational concepts, technology, and policy when it comes to air and space power. So if you like learning about aerospace power, you are in the right place. To our regular listeners, thank you so much for coming back. And if it's your first time, we really appreciate you joining us. As we kick off 2022, we thought it would be a great time to gauge what we should be thinking about this year when it comes to China. Obviously, there's a lot of talk about the 2022 Olympics, and we also want to dive a bit further into what may be some key events and developments in China that will impact U.S. and China relations moving forward. So to dive into this, I'd like to welcome back Mitchell Institute research analyst Daniel Rice to the show. You might have heard Dan before on the podcast, but for those that don't know him, Dan is our resident China expert and a graduate of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He lived in China for several years and is fluent in Mandarin Chinese. Well, Dan, welcome to the show. It's always a pleasure having you here.
Thank you so much, Slick. It's awesome to be here.
Well, you know, we're kicking off into January of 2022, and we're looking forward to this new year. And if you can break it down for us, what are some big things that we should be watching when it comes to China in 2022?
Sure, Slick. So I've kind of identified five key things that I'll be looking at and I think are important for everybody to be watching. So number one, we've got China's 20th Party Congress and the implications for what that is and what it means for China. Number two, we've got what the outcome of that Congress means for China's international affairs and their foreign policy. Number three, there's the big ticket regional comprehensive economic partnership that came into effect on January 1st, and it'll be rolling out really this year. Number four is different activities in South Asia and Southeast Asia that China's likely to pursue. And number five really is the changing of perceptions from the China populace to the U.S., how they're perceiving the U.S., and also how the U.S. is perceiving China.
Well, Dan, I appreciate that. And it's a lot to take in at once. So I'm going to ask you, if you don't mind, to start breaking some of these things down for us. And let's start at the top and work down from there. So first off, can you explain what is the Party Congress and why does it matter?
Sure. So the Party Congress is essentially an election. And these elections take place every 5 years. And from the very bottom levels of the Chinese Communist Party all the way to the top, they elect leadership at different levels. So what's important for us is that they'll be electing the top leadership for the Chinese Communist Party.
So Dan, is this essentially picking, you know, obviously key leaders? Would this be like the equivalent of picking like the cabinet?
Yes, exactly. So at least for our purposes, the thing that we want to be watching is that cabinet level selection. And at that top, you've got three really big bodies. You've got the Central Committee, which is roughly 205 members. And then you've got the Politburo, which is made up of roughly 25 members, and that's starting the cabinet level positions. And then you've got the very, very top of kind of a pyramid here, which is the Standing Committee, and that's currently made up of 7 members. So from the Politburo up to the Standing Committee, that's where you hit that cabinet level decision making.
Okay. Yeah, and this discussion really makes me realize how much I don't understand about the inner workings of the Chinese government. So this is massively helpful. So with that being said, what's so special about this this particular party's Congress, you know, that you call it the 20th Congress, and what makes this different from, you know, the previous iteration, the 19th or whatever Congresses were before?
So the 20th Party Congress is different than ones in the past because in this party Congress, if Xi Jinping takes a third term, he will be leading China for 3 consecutive terms. And that's a really big deal. There's also some inner workings in terms of actual people selected to that cabinet level decision making that might also shake up some of the ways that the CCP is looking at different issue areas.
So Dan, is there some history here? Is there any precedents that he would be breaking with this third term?
Yeah, so it's going to get a little wonky here for a second, but essentially, ever since Mao Zedong, the Chinese leadership has taken a 3-in-1 model. It's called the Sunwei Yiti, whereby the leader of China concurrently holds 3 of the highest posts in the government. And those posts are the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, the president of the country and the chairman of the Central Military Commission. And so what happened was that back in 2018, Xi Jinping, he removed the two-term limit on the president, which is the only position of the three that had a term limit, which means that in the future, any leader of China can really hold all three titles for as long as they are able. And by that, I mean, you know, if they're even too old to actually be involved in politics, if they have the political will necessary to remain the leader of the country, and any internal factions or any internal politics that might actually remove them from the position.
Okay, so this really is a big deal. And I think that's obviously what the audience needs to take away from that. So is there anything else going on in the Party Congress that we should be watching out for?
Yeah, so on the foreign affairs front, there's actually potentially going to be quite a big shakeup. And the current director of the General Office of the Central Foreign Affairs Commission, Yang Jiechi, and also Foreign Minister Wang Yi are both set to retire this year, and there's no obvious replacements for them. And Yang Jiechi himself is actually part of that Politburo, or that top 25-member leadership level that I discussed earlier. So without a replacement for him, it means that foreign policy is going to have a few less checks and balances when it comes to decision-making.
So what I understand, Dan, is now the president is also assuming the role of what we would have as a secretary of state. So what does that mean for China's leadership for the rest of the world?
Yeah, so it's not necessarily that he's assuming that title, but it's more like he doesn't really have a secretary of state at that very top level. So what it means is that likely Xi Jinping will play an outsized role in directing foreign affairs. And that really is important when we're thinking about how the Chinese Communist Party is thinking about foreign affairs and who has the final say in a lot of the decisions, which will really just fall to Xi Jinping now. So his perceptions of the world and the way that he's seeing either geopolitical lines being drawn or what he perceives as aggression towards China is likely going to be reflected in more policy-level decisions.
Yeah, so not really having any sort of checks and balances like we have here in the States. So are there any areas where we might see this play out and have an effect, positive or negative, or do you think it'll just be business as usual?
Yeah, so now's a really good time to bring up what I mentioned earlier in the top five things to watch, and that's the RCEP, or the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. So with this kind of consolidated decision-making in foreign policy, one of the things that we might see is that Xi Jinping could capitalize on this trade agreement. And it's a really big trade agreement. It covers 30% of global GDP, 30% of the population, and roughly $26.2 trillion of trade. It also includes some of our key allies and partners in the region, namely Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and South Korea. So if Xi Jinping wants to leverage this kind of trade agreement, it would really make a lot of sense, especially for China's near abroad, as they term it. So the geopolitical line drawing that Xi Jinping could do in the area means that it might be more difficult for us to conduct joint operations or joint exercises with our allies and partners in the region. And that's because he'll be able to leverage that economic stick, really, over the countries.
Sure. Well, let's drill down even further within the region. Are there any specific areas we should be looking at that will be important to track and kind of measure how this RCEP is working?
Yeah. So I've kind of identified three really key areas. And the first of those is really the Mekong River area. And that's a huge trade area between China, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand. There's a lot of issues in play in that area, specifically national security issues for China. It makes up the Golden Triangle, which is one of the largest drug trafficking areas in the world. There's a lot of river politics in terms of water supply that China has a little bit of control over because they've got around 11 dams upstream. So it really impacts those economies and the livelihoods of people downstream. So you've also got countries like Sri Lanka, and as we know, China built the port of Hambantota there as part of their String of Pearls strategy in the Indian Ocean. But they're actually also building a financial center there, which is the Colombo Port City project. So we're seeing China take more aggressive development opportunities in different countries in Southeast Asia and solidifying the ones that they've already got in play. And the third area that I would be watching is actually more Central Asia. But China, with their Belt and Road Initiative, they're really looking to kind of shore up the economic channels through Central Asia. So there'll be likely a lot of activity over there.
Yeah, it's a good transition. I know you've kind of gone through the first three bullet points and the fourth one, which I'm really interested in asking you about. With the pullout of the U.S. coming out of Afghanistan, obviously that was a huge deal. So are there any developments on what China might be doing in this region now that the U.S. is gone?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I've talked about it a little bit before on the podcast. So Afghanistan's really a key component for China's strategy in Central Asia and really linking to Europe. And there's a lot of issues in play in Afghanistan. You've got not only drug trafficking in terms of opium, you've also got radical Islamic fundamentalism that they're afraid might spill over into Xinjiang. You've also got infrastructure projects and resources in Afghanistan that China's really interested in getting at. And you've also got an area for China to start testing its overseas abilities in conducting either stability or military operations. And that's related to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which involves many of the Central Asian states, including Russia. So because the U.S. is no longer in Afghanistan, it's opened up a lot of opportunity for China to start testing out different ways in which they can bring Afghanistan into their economic fold. And one of the main ways they're really looking at doing that is involving Pakistan and involving Afghanistan in the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is one of the key areas for the Belt and Road. So while we haven't to date seen China really operationalize anything in Afghanistan, whether it be military or economic projects, it is absolutely an area that they're looking to really shore up their influence in, and we'll be pushing pretty aggressively to do so in the near future.
Well, Dan, no, I do appreciate that, and obviously making the connection between having access to Afghanistan and the drugs there, and then the connection that you made with the Mekong River area, it's pretty scary just on the drug front. But we've covered a lot of ground so far, and it seems like there's a lot of changes going on in China, but I'd like to get your take on how the U.S. and China are perceiving these different events.
The different perceptions is kind of a little bit of a funny one, and John Pomfret actually has a really good book called The Beautiful Country in the Middle Kingdom that describes this trend in perceptions of the different populaces, wherein at times the U.S. and China are really friendly and the people really understand and enjoy each other's cultures, and then at other times we take a very adversarial approach to each other. And so what we see right now is that the Chinese populace is really starting to embrace the fact that they are on the rise for a lot of good reasons, namely because the Chinese populace is getting more wealthy. The economic policies that the CCP has put in place has really benefited your average Chinese citizen. And they see that, as with their economic rise, that they should start taking a more active role in international affairs. And then on the domestic front, things like censorship and really centralized control over domestic narratives is actually surprisingly not that big a deal for your average Chinese citizen. And I've seen interviews that people have conducted on the streets asking this question. And the overall takeaway really is, as long as at the end of the day that the Chinese people are seeing economic gains, they're really not too concerned about how China is going about doing that. And so when it comes to the Chinese perception of the U.S., they're looking at things that we're doing as impeding China's ability to make good on economic promises. And so there's almost a little bit of an adversarial view growing there, which has not historically been there. Last time I was in China, people were saying that the U.S. was what they called the Dage, or, the big brother, somebody to look up to and really look to as a role model. So that's been changing a little bit. And so for the U.S. perceptions on China, you know, based on all of the things that I've read in the news, in my interactions with people discussing China, there's obviously this feeling of China being very threatening. And from where I sit, there's kind of this conundrum that we find ourselves in, and that's that the media narratives coming out of China are very, very controlled, and they're starting to look more aggressive. And there's also a very high barrier to entry in terms of understanding the Chinese populace, and that barrier is language. So if you can't really read Chinese or speak Chinese, all you're really going to be getting is that very controlled narrative out of China. And when we're thinking about how that reflects in the U.S. media, things that really influence our perceptions of China, you're going to get a lot of the same. And it creates this echo chamber wherein China does become more threatening because that's all we can really get access to understand what they are thinking.
Well, Dan, I wanted to ask you, because one of the big things we hear a lot about is Chinese influence operations. And is there some of that going on here? What is China doing to shape or control their own narrative?
Yeah, so influence operations is a really, really interesting topic. And there's almost two sides to it. One is domestic and one is international. And so there are two really big events coming up that are really good examples of both types. So you've got the Chinese New Year's or Spring Festival called Chunjie, which will happen in the beginning of February. And you've also got the Beijing Olympics. And so the Spring Festival is a really important time for the CCP to shape a domestic narrative. And how that really happens is kind of like in the US during our New Year's, how we have the ball drop on Times Square that everybody used to watch. They've got something called the Spring Festival Gala that they put out. And, you know, during Spring Festival, almost every single household in China will be sitting down and watching the gala. And to put that in context, I believe it's the most watched television program in the world. So what really has happened over the past 5 years is that that Spring Gala went from really celebrating Chinese culture, comedy, food, and all sorts of different arts to having a very, very strong party line that it follows. And so having that really strong party line makes it so that they can control the narrative to the domestic populace very tightly. And a lot of it has to do with stamping out corruption, supporting the party, and embracing military development. So during this Spring Festival, it'll be very interesting to see how China paints the portrait of the CCP to the Chinese populace. And so for the international component, in terms of the Beijing Olympics, China's got to be very, very careful about how they pull it off. And what I mean is that there's a lot of issues in play, right? We've got COVID going around, and with so many different countries traveling to China to partake in the games, it's going to be very difficult to control that. And, you know, if there's a huge outbreak of COVID, that's going to really not send a good signal to the international scene. So there's going to be a lot of different things that China can do to shape that narrative for that international audience. And that could manifest itself in some of the influence operations that we traditionally think of. And what I mean by that is social media. As we've seen in the past couple years, TikTok was a big platform for promoting a pro-CCP line. And so other social media channels like Facebook and Twitter are also being used to really shape the narrative that China wants to present to the international audience. So those are really things that we need to be watching for, is how they're going to be using these different channels to influence the way that we're perceiving Chinese actions and what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're bringing a lot of things just to my own attention to start looking out for. Well, Dan, thanks so much for such a great outlook and things for us to be tracking in 2022. But before I let you go, let's put this through a military lens. And what should our men and women in uniform who are stationed in the Pacific expect to see over the coming months, given all these variables? And I get it. What you described was a lot of strategic stuff, but the end effect has to obviously make an impact at the operational and tactical levels.
Yes, like, so let me bring it back to the military lens. So I mentioned a little bit earlier the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the potential for that being operationalized in Afghanistan. So one of the big things that we just saw happen in Kazakhstan was that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization offered to put forward troops to stabilize the country, but they did not. And instead, Russia had to step in and send their troops in. So what can we glean from that is that while China, through the SCO, has the ambition to have that kind of capability, they, as of now, are unable to field it. And that's really important because that type of overseas operations is something that China has been striving to accomplish for quite some time now. And that actually also plays into Xi Jinping taking three terms as president. So part of that overseas capability is having a modern military. And so before, we saw Xi Jinping setting the flagpole as 2049 as having a fully modernized military, and that was pushed forward to actually 2035. And most recently, it was pushed to 2027, celebrating the centennial of the founding of the People's Liberation Army. So 2027 is the goal, and it makes a lot of sense as well in terms of politics because that's when Xi Jinping will be wrapping up his third term as the preeminent leader of China. So it would gain him really, really good political points to have a fully modernized military if he tries to take a fourth term as the leader of China. So what that means for our men and women in uniform is that China's really going to be pushing, developing the capabilities to be able to operate beyond their borders on an accelerated timeline. So we can expect that China's really going to be trying to shore up their C4ISR capabilities. They're going to be developing more practical CONOPs and really shoring up their military doctrine to support those overseas operations. And then another really important thing here is that they'll be training for those operations. And I spoke with Ken Allen and Dr. Brendan Mulvaney on the podcast a few months ago. And one of the things that they've really noticed is that actual military training, specifically in joint operations, has really ramped up in China. So they're not just trying to get the overall architecture to execute this mission set. They're also training to practically employ it. And then another really significant thing is that if Xi Jinping continues to lead the country, you can expect a lot of the same out of China. And I mean more aggressive foreign policy, that accelerated military buildup, because it'll all be under Xi Jinping. So don't expect a radical shakeup in any sort of strategy out of China. They're probably just going to continue on the same path. And finally, tying back to foreign policy and economics, so with things like the RCEP now in place, it means that when we're looking towards Southeast Asia or South Asia, now those countries will have this economic agreement kind of hanging above their heads when they decide which way they should go in terms of siding more with the US or siding with China. And as much as we can provide those military assurances to those countries, almost all of them are really looking for more economic growth. So it's going to be more difficult to solidify those partnerships and solidify those allies in the region.
Yeah, Dan, I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for being here today. I know we're getting a little short on time, so thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Slick.
Thank you, our listeners, for your continued support, and thank you for tuning in today. We've got a lot of new and exciting content coming your way, including some deep dives on space capabilities, followed by another installment of our monthly roundtable, The Rendezvous. This year, we're headed out to air and space events near you, so don't forget to follow or subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn to find out where we'll be and what the Mitchell team has in our sight picture. And please, don't forget to leave us a rating. Hit the like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. Also, leave us a comment to let us know what you think about our podcast and let us know areas you think we should explore further. please visit us at MitchellAerospacePower.org to read the latest reports, events, and analysis that are charting the vectors for our air and space forces. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Stay safe and check six.